look, it's take two. Landed adjacent to take one. It's a very lovely thing. But another thing about Napoleon and Napoleon. Joaquin Phoenix, which is where we were, where we concluded our previous conversation. If you haven't heard it yet, you know, you might want to go back and do that. I'm kind of annoyed in retrospect that I didn't pick this up and bring it up with Joaquin Phoenix. I don't like people wearing hats indoors. And I think Napoleon wears a hat.
All the way.
All the way through.
Even in some of the love scenes.
Yeah, even, and it's that hat. It's the big sideways on hat. Even when he's at some kind of cocktail party, he's wearing the hat as if to say, look at me, I'm Napoleon.
And there's a thing that goes on with the angle at which he wears the hat, that he turns the hat, you know, sideways and then forwards another time. There is, it's like it's kind of like a weather vane of his emotional life.
So the first thing you say is, Napoleon, take your hat off.
Yeah, exactly. And the second thing we should say is, if you've listened to Take One already, apparently Seaside Arms.
Oh, Spandau Ballet.
Nabokov.
Nabokov.
Yeah.
Lolita.
Well, this is this was top production team. So apparently there was an interview in The Guardian, you know, how we made true. And Gary Kemp said he's had a lot of flack over the years for Seaside Arms. He said, but it's from Nabokov. It's from Lolita, as indeed is Don't Stand So Close to Me. It's just like the old man in that book by Nabokov.
Yes.
But so I still don't know what Seaside Arms means, even in the Lolita context of it.
And apparently it's a reference to Claire Grogan. It's a song all about Gary being in love with Claire Grogan, as indeed everybody was at the time.
Did she have Seaside Arms?
I don't know what they are.
Did she have a fruit machine?
I don't think so.
Simon Poole thought it might have been a fruit machine. Like you're thinking like one-armed bandit, right? Yeah, one Seaside-armed bandit. No, turns out Nabokov.
Still doesn't make a lot of sense.
Still doesn't make a lot of sense.
Anyway.
And sand is not a time of its own.
Lewis Holtby says on the email to correspondence@cobinomeo.com, small contribution to your recent discussion on the topic of actors you mistake for each other.
Yes.
I have three pairs of actors who I not only confused with each other, but actually thought they were the same.
Okay.
Perhaps exceptionally prolific individuals for many years. Pete Postlethwaite and Alan Armstrong. The thing that finally blew this illusion apart for me was seeing them appear alongside each other in the film Split Second. But no, I can definitely see that.
And that, when with the Nocturnal Animals thing, with the Amy Adams and Isla Fisher, I know at least one person who said it was only when I saw them both in the same film that I realised they weren't the same person.
Toby Stevens and Stephen Campbell Moore. No, that actually isn't Maggie Smith's son alongside the Staith in The Bank Job. And Michael Cera and Jesse Eisenberg. I still don't believe these are two different people. It'd be interesting to hear if Mark or other listeners have experienced similar confusion between any of these.
Well, as I said, I absolutely did do it with Amy Adams and Isla Fisher when they were both less famous than they are now. I get a lot the Mark Lamar or, the Mark Lamar one is the one that actually kind of sticks around. It's bizarre. People go, oh, yeah, weren't you? Isn't that Mark Lamar? Or Mark Cousins, which is weird because Mark Cousins and I look nothing like each other. But we're both called Mark.
Paul in South Wales, please would you find 30 seconds to give a shout out to an astonishingly great screen presence, that of Joss Ackland. He may not have had the most famous starring roles, but he was an assuredly fine actor and accomplished thespian. We lost him this week, obviously. Yeah. For my part, I shall always remember him as the arch nemesis of Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves in the sequel of Bill and Ted, a masterful performer I shall never forget. And there was a Napoleon in Bill and Ted.
There is a Napoleon in Bill and Ted, yes. I mean, there are Napoleons throughout the history of cinema, the most famous one being the one in Time Bandits. When he meets the Time Bandits, he immediately makes them all his generals because they're shorter than him. And he then does that drunken dinner scene in which he recounts all the great leaders of the world and says that they were all 5'1".
Have I remembered this?
Joss Ackland had the most incredible voice.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Most incredible speaking voice. It was like a voice of treacle cake.
And Tim Rice wrote a very nice piece about Joss Ackland, who played Perron in Evita.
Oh, right.
And so, yeah, absolutely. You know, a great presence and a fantastic voice. It seemed to be, I have remembered, maybe this is completely wrong, that kind of a staple, maybe a got too corny. If people were trying to portray events in a madhouse of some kind, there would always be an old guy who thought he was Napoleon. Who would just be sitting there. He thinks he's Napoleon.
Yeah. In fact, there is a line in The Exorcist, which is, your daughter doesn't say she's a demon. She says she's the devil himself. If you've seen as many psychiatric patients as I have, you'd know that's the same as saying you're Napoleon Bonaparte.
And I don't think this is a spoiler, but Napoleon, the film, the Sir Ridley, kind of ends up with the madman in the corner who thinks he's Napoleon.
That's right, it does. Absolutely does.
Who just happens to be Napoleon.
Yes.
Anyway, so...
telling his story to two young children.
Yeah.
Going, I was great, me. I was great.
Correspondence at kevinamayo.com. Please get involved. Tell us something that is out that we might like to go and see.
Wish, which is the new film from Disney Animation, the studio's centenary year. A point that is rammed home during the movie. Directed by Chris Buck, co-director of the Frozen movies, and Fawn Veerasinthorn, who is making her feature directorial debut. Chris Pine is the voice of King Magnifico, who is founder of the Kingdom of Rosas. He collects wishes from his subjects when they turn 18. And then he has these big wish parties in which he can make a wish come true. So kind of like a, you know, Cilla Black for the Disney generation. Ariane DeBose's Asha, who is a teenager with a 100-year-old grandfather. She wants to become Magnifico's assistant because she thinks that if she becomes his assistant, this will give her grandfather a greater chance of his wish coming true because, you know, she'll be close to Magnifico. All sounds whoop-de-doo, but is it right that people should have their dreams taken away from them when they get to the right age? Should someone else have the power to make our dreams come true? And I mean this in a very real sense, Simon.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you wish upon a star? Here's a clip.
Boom! Did we just blow your mind?
Uh-huh. Well, I've known the entire time.
When it comes to the universe, we're all shareholders.
Get that for your system.
Solar! See, we were all just little nebulae in a nursery from supernovas. Now we've grown into our history. We're taking wise right out of mystery closure. Now we're taking it
all the star closure.
We eat the leaves and we eat the sun.
See, that's where all the balls of gas come from.
Hey, you still look like you're hanging on by a strand.
But if you just see the mushrooms, then you'll understand.
So your dust is my dust? Fantastic!
Woo! Well, you don't have to look too hard. It's all around you, not too far. If you try to figure out just who you are,
you're a star.
Would Wish work as a double bill with Tish? Would that
actually
work?
Actually, that's very good. Yes, I wish to see Wish and Tish.
Thank you.
Together. Talking Goat Valentino in a song telling us there that we are all stars. In fact, we are stardust. We are golden.
Well, we actually
and
are,
we've
though.
We've got to find our way back to the garden. We are stardust.
Yes.
Yes, in a very real sense of the word. In fact, that's a theme that is explored very much in Carol Morley's film, Out of Blue.
Moby had a song, We're All Made of Stars.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing.
Factually and scientifically accurate. So the film is filled with knowing nods to Disney's past. So you get, you know, like, oh, look, there's Bambi, there's Peter Pan, there's a castle that looks, you know, it's the Disney castle. There's the score keeps going. Da 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 da.
Almost.
And then it'll go da 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 da. So, songs by Julian Michaels and Benjamin Rice that sound honestly like something that if you went to AI or Chat GBT or whatever it's called and went, write me some songs for an uplifting Disney film with an eye on its heritage, AI would have come up with these. Even, I mean, if you think about the kind of the classic Disney songbook, whether it's the Sherman Brothers or whether it's, you know, the Alan Menken, they knew how to write great show tunes. I'm not saying that these tunes aren't fine, and I am very conscious of the fact that when we were reviewing the Greatest Showman, I did say not a memorable tune in it. Last time I looked, 3 billion albums sold. But they did it all feel to me like it was, you know, toothpaste produced, here's a Disney song. Even the kind of central subversion of the story, you know, the prince is a megalomaniac, the princess is resourceful and independent. Even that now feels a bit like, it's perfectly fine. It's messages of self-empowerment and, you know, following one's own star are flawless in the sense that they are completely plastic, that it's like, you know, there's no rough edges, there's no, it's just, yeah, like, and weirdly for a film that is built on the thesis of wishes, what this doesn't have is magic. Now, I'm absolutely clear, I'm absolutely certain that some people will go along and they will like it, and it's because it's, you know, it's robustly likable. In a way which, you know, all my favorite Disneys have got spiky edges and have got, you know, problems. I mean, obviously, in terms of the live action stuff, Mary Poppins, but I think of, you know, Hunchback of Notre Dame, which I absolutely love. And I love the songs. I love the performances. You know, not perhaps considered to be one of the studio's finest works, but I think, you know, absolutely magnificent. This just felt like the Big Mac of Disney movies. It's just... You know that Disney movie? It's that. And all the Easter eggs and all the nodding to the past. And then we were told at the beginning, stay to the very end of the credits because there's a scene at the end. And the scene at the end is that they do a big thing. They play the song and they tell you that it's 100 years of Disney. You go, oh, okay. So not really a scene, more of an advert.
Is it worth staying for?
No. No, the end's no, absolutely not. It's absolutely.
So leave as soon
absolutely,
as it says
yeah. You don't
the
need
end.
To stay for the bit at the end. It's not. You know, it's not worth it. But it's fine, but bland with a capital bleh.
On the subject of opening lines from songs,
oh yes,
Vin Duggal, hey Vin,
Vin as in VIN.
Yes, my yeah. contribution to great opening lines is from A Design for Life by the Mannix. Libraries gave us power, then work came and set us free. What price now for a shallow piece of dignity?
Yes, it
that's
is.
Good.
It's a great line. Great opening.
The song
line.
Itself is near perfect and came up after the tragic disappearance of Richie Edwards. Thanks for everything. Down with social media, says Vin Duggal. Thank you, Vin. Owen Bywater. Dear Charters and Caldecott, greetings from sunny Wandsworth and hello to Jess the Wonder Poodle. Surely there is a clear winner for best opening line from a song, plus a neat connection.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is.
Okay.
On a morning from a Bogart movie, in a country where they turn back time, you go strolling through the crowd like Peter Lorre contemplating a crime. Year of the Cat.
Oh!
Al Stewart.
Wow.
You have to kind of say it in that affected way that it was natural to him, but it sounds very kind of...
Yeah.
Plummy in English.
I like Year of the Cat. I did
strange, mysterious, evocative and brilliant, says Owen.
Read it again.
On a morning from a Bogart movie, in a country where they turn back time, you go strolling through the crowd like Peter Lorre contemplating a crime.
Okay.
Let's say Peter Lorre in the way that he sings it. Peter Lorre.
Peter Lorre.
Andy in Wisconsin. On the subject of greatest opening lyrics, the previous correspondent's mention of Ben Folds 5 gives us passage to recognise Mr. Folds for one of the finest verses ever written.
Go on.
From his solo effort, The Luckiest. Consider. Next door, there's an old man who lived to his 90s and one day passed away in his sleep. And his wife, she stayed for a couple of days and passed away. I'm sorry, I know that's a strange way to tell you that. I know we belong. I have utterly nothing more to add, says Andy. These are the kind of words that you clear a path for. I like that.
Yeah, wow. Wow.
If there are words you clear a path for, correspondence@kirbynandmayo.com. What else is out?
Lost in the Night, which is a Mexican, German, Dutch, Danish, Spanish language drama.
Tell us about that co-production again.
So the co-production is Mexican, German, Dutch, Danish. It is a Spanish language drama, Perdidos en la Noche, played at Cannes in May, from co-writer and director Amat Escalante, who made the 2013 Cannes Prize winner Heli, which I reviewed with you a decade ago now, and which I said was really... quite an overwhelming experience. I mean, often very, very grim, but really, really powerful. Juan Daniel Garcia Trevino is Emiliano, who is the son of a woman who protested against the opening of a local mine and who was then disappeared, as in, you know, taken off. Nobody quite knows what happened. By chance, Emiliano finds himself in the company of a dying cop who... gives him a tip-off because he's searching for his mother. And he follows this tip-off to the house of a conceptual artist, Rigo, who is the kind of person who sells shock and, outrage for a living, and who has a dog called Bunuel, that kind of person.
Okay.
So he goes to the house with his girlfriend, Jasmine, posing as a couple looking for work. And when they get there, they find that Rigo and his family have had their dogs poisoned, although Bunuel has survived. Here's a clip.
¿Te conocen?
Sí, digamos que es cliente frecuente. No les gusta la mina.
Íbamos regresando de un paseo por el lago. Vimos las patrullas, nada más. Fue coincidencia.
Pues ni tanta coincidencia. También íbamos a pasar con ustedes para ver si tienen trabajo.
Pues buen timing, ¿eh? Los envenenaron a los perros. Solo sobrevivió Bunuel. ¿Qué tipo de trabajo están buscando?
Ella es niñera, yo sé algo de carpintería, jardinería, mantenimiento en general.
So basically what he's trying to do is to inveigle his way into the confidence of these people because he believes that somehow his mother's disappearance is connected to this land. Rigo's partner is Carmen, who's famous as a singer. Her daughter posts suicide-themed videos on social media, videos in which she appears to be staging her own suicide. And there is a big thing about this at the beginning of the movie. It opens with an epitaph, which kind of talks about suicide. And then what follows is this very strange hodgepodge of, you know, on the one hand, hard-boiled Tex-Mex crime drama. There's a weird kind of Larry Clark element in terms of the adolescent sexual odyssey, which is kind of quite explicit and also very angsty. There's a kind of satire going on about the art world, about this artist who makes these shock installations, but they're kind of crass and empty, and also about social media and the idea that you would post these kind of suicide-themed videos. And there's also at the center of it this kind of oddly cheesy youth detective yarn in which, you know, a young person is on the trail of a mystery that they're trying to solve, and by doing that they go. So it's odd. It's got atmosphere to spare. The choreography of the imagery is striking. I mean, right, the house that they're in is the most unbelievable creation. And there are things in it that are, arresting, and much like the art at the center of it, sometimes sort of quite shockingly frank. The thing which is weird is that for a film with so much going on, it feels oddly insubstantial. And I was reminded of how powerful I had found Heli, how very, very distressing I had found Heli. I went back and watched that, my review of that again, and I read the notes that I had made because I keep my notebooks, weirdly enough. And so I think there are things in this that are interesting and distracting, but I think for a film that's got so much in it, there's actually surprisingly little in it, and it's certainly not on a par with the director's previous work. Not to say that there aren't moments in it that are very striking, but they're moments. They're scattershot moments rather than something sort of coherent and growing.
Lost in the Night.
Lost in the Night.
Where can I see that? Is that like a cinema thing?
Yes, again, but it'll be a small release. You know, it's. I fully expect that we will get an email from somebody who saw it and got more out of it than I did, is what okay. I fully expect.
And if that is you, correspondence at kerbinamayor.com. Girl will be the next film reviewed. However, yes. First of all, it's very important that we squeeze in another round of pretentious moi, particularly okay. with the reassurance I can give you, Mark, that I think you're going to get this.
Okay, but you say that every week now, and that's kind of...
I think I'm kind of right.
But also that kind of undermines the victory when I do get it right, because it's like, well, of course he was going to get that right, you know.
Okay, I think you're worrying too much. Thinking
How unlike me.
Overthinking. Cue the pretension bed, please.
Pretension bed.
So
that sounds like an art installation.
It does.
The pretension bed.
There is one name that has been replaced. I think you'll notice it when we get there.
Okay.
No question that you're going to get this. Without taking anything away from your victory, I think it'll be straightforward.
That's really passive aggressive what you're doing. You know that, don't you?
It's straightforward, really. Here's the quote. There's a hard scrabble sense of ordinary aging folk making the best of a bad deal in often desolate and unforgiving circumstances. Yet whatever hardships they face, it's the air of community and self-determination that rings throughout Lord Farquaad's empathic film.
So it's a film about old people.
Hard scrabble. Ordinary aging folk making the best of a bad deal in often desolate and unforgiving circumstances. Yet whatever hardships they face, it's the air of community and self-determination that rings throughout Lord Farquaad's empathic film.
Why were you so confident that I would get it?
Because of your encyclopedic knowledge.
I mean, it sounds recent to me.
I just have complete faith in your encyclopedic knowledge.
I'm trying to think what films I've reviewed about. I mean, all I can think of is things like, you know,
Think of a hardscrabble film.
Yeah, I
think. How do you define hardscrabble?
Well, hardscrabble is you usually poverty line, difficult existence.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not dystopian. It sounds like it's social realist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it may be Ken Loach, but it's not Ken Loach, I don't think. No, honestly, nothing springs immediately to mind.
Full quote, there's a hardscrabble sense of ordinary aging folk making the best of a bad deal in often desolate and unforgiving circumstances.
Yeah.
Yet whatever hardships they face, it's the air of community and self-determination that rings throughout Chloe Zhao's empathetic
film. Oh!
Nomadland. 2021. That's why I thought, because it was such an award-laden movie.
Yeah. No, you're right, but I think the thing that put me off was the aging, but yes, no, you're absolutely right. And I didn't spot that. So there we go. So,
I apologize for my misplaced.
No, I didn't spot it pretty largely because you'd done that, because you put me off my game.
Right. So it's my
your fault.
So the
Okay. Yeah. So in fact, that's what was the original score?
23-20.
And then Simon Mayo
minus
nil.
Minus one. Got to be on nil. Got to be on minus one. Okay, very good. Well, okay. Better luck next time. We'll make it easy.
Yeah. Okay.
Next week. Okay.
That was very patronizing.
It was.
Do you do that at home?
Girl is.
Do you get out. Shown the front door?
No.
When you do that?
Shut the front door.
Do your younger people say that?
When they were with us. Yeah, it's quite good, actually. It's like shiitake mushrooms. It's actually quite useful.
Yes, I hadn't heard of
that was in Spy, the first Spy movie, the first Spy Kids movie, which was pretty good. There's a moment of peril, and one of the children says, "Oh, shiitake mushrooms." You go, smart.
Yeah, or "Oh shit, two dogs." That's the other one.
I don't think that's appropriate.
But there is a dog called a shih tzu.
I know, but okay. You made it. I think you dwelt. You didn't dwell on the zoo.
It's actually a line from Repossessed, in which whoever it is says, "Oh, you little shih tzu."
Very good.
Okay.
Anyway,
and there's a television
out.
Program called Schitt's Creek. So frankly, the gloves are off.
Is that right?
Yes. You know that there is.
That was such an overrated series.
I think I saw a series of it.
We did it on the show.
Okay. So Girl, which is the debut feature from writer-director Ajira Onoshile, who I had the great privilege of interviewing on stage at BFI, British-Nigerian playwright turned filmmaker. This expands on a short film that she made in 2020. A working-class mother, Grace, played by Deborah Lukuamina, and her young daughter, Amma, played by Lashanti Bonsu, are holed up in their Glasgow apartment. The whole film is shot like in the apartment. It's like a kind of like almost a magical cave, a magical realm in which the pair have constructed this kind of fairy tale reality in which they are insulated and isolated from the outside world, and their entire sense of the world they live in is defined by the stories that they spin around each other. Here's a clip.
Will you tell me the story?
Me home and living with my grandmother.
You will get some water from a well and you made a wish.
That I would have somebody who could be my friend.
So you won't be lonely.
So I won't be lonely.
And you waited and waited, and almost gave up hope.
Yes.
But then I came along.
And I'll never be lonely again.
So that's Deborah Lukumuena and Lashanti Bonsu in Girl. And what then happens is that for these two characters, this is both a palace and a prison, a castle and an entrapment. And inevitably for the young girl who's 11, the outside world will come calling. And in fact, it comes calling because she's looking out the window and she sees a fire in an opposite block, and she cries out. And that cry kind of crosses the great chasm. And the next thing is that it's created a bond between her and her neighbor and classmate Fiona, and it opens doors to the outside world for her. But it also means that her mother is left bereft because this person that she's kept absolutely welded to her is suddenly not entirely with her anymore. I think the film's got real tenderness to it. It's got real texture. I mean, it's a beautifully tactile film. It's really, really beautifully shot. And it straddles the boundaries between, this weirdly enough relates to something we were just saying about in Pretentious Moir. It has a kitchen sink realism in that it's about people in hard scrabble life. But it has a magical realist element that makes it kind of poetic and makes it feel like what you're dealing with is myth and fairy tale and stories from the past and stories from the future all coinciding within this tiny little apartment. And so although the subject matter can be very, very bleak, it is very vibrant and alive. It's got a brilliant score by Ray Olanuga, which I thought really added to the air of mystery and magic and, you know, interpersonal intrigue. And it was one of those films when, you know, watching it is a bit like watching a spell. You know, you're kind of enchanted by it and mesmerized by it, even though perhaps you don't fully understand it at the time. A very, very strong atmosphere, and I think a real indication that Adriana Schiele has got great things ahead of her in the film world. Definitely a name to look out for.
And a cinematic release.
Yes.
Cinematic release.
And worth seeing on a big screen, definitely, because of the way it looks. It's really atmospheric.
Lauren Hurley says, "Dear Nick Cage and Nick Cave, on the subject of relatives that have been involved in films, my husband's paternal grandfather, Alec Hurley, played Crow, the villain, in the 1929 film The Flying Scotsman, one of the first films to be played with sound. Unfortunately, wow. IMDb have confused him with his brother, Alec Hurley, the music hall singer, which I will try to rectify on behalf of my father-in-law, his son, Dr. Alec Hurley." So if anyone is listening from IMDb, there's the correction.
Incidentally, what you could do, if you email, you have just emailed that to the show, we will forward that email on to the guy who runs the IMDb.
Okay. "The actors on this film," says Lauren, "notoriously did their own stunts on the train. I've included a couple of stills below of Alec very narrowly surviving passing through a tunnel whilst on the outside of the train." Lauren, thank you very much for that. Mark in Inverness. "Doctors, I was delighted to learn that Mark eats pizza exactly the same way as me. But there is one detail that I missed if it was already covered. When eating an unsliced pizza,
yes,
cutlery or no cutlery? For me, pizza is to be eaten by hand, so no matter how hot, it's always no cutlery. I'd be interested in your thoughts on this matter of vital importance. Hello to Jason, up with a few hours of escapism from the awfulness of the world that you and the team provide us with every week, down with depressing stories and images that seem to fill the news every day. Why can't we all just get along? Would it help if I bought the world a Coke? Would there be peace throughout the land?" Cutlery or no cutlery?
Well, I confess that I do use cutlery. I don't use it. Why? Because you have to do the round the edges thing. So yes, I have it on the plate, knife and fork, all the way around the edges.
And then Mark from Inverness just says, no, sorry.
No, it's fair enough. It's obviously, well, I'm, you know.
One frame back is all
just
about
ask
Napoleon
give
films.
Honest answer.
There are lots of Napoleon films. And if you want to hear more about Napoleon, listen to the Whacking Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby interview Without any kind of racial stereotyping.
Remember that rockabilly song, "Not Tonight, Josephine, Not Tonight," and then in the third verse, "Yes Tonight, Josephine."
No. Ash,
I'm sure you could find it.
Says Bill, yeah, but we can't play it because we can't afford it.
Could play the Dodge Brothers Christmas single. There's three tracks out now that you could put at the end of take. You could put at the end of questions. I give you permission. We own the rights.
Ash. Said,
run out of time.
Yeah, there's no time.
Okay.
Ash says, Bill and Ted's ice cream eating, water slide obsessed Napoleon is 100% the best, played by Terry Camilleri. David says, my vote goes to Ian Holm, who was not only my top Napoleon, but was also two other Napoleons in Napoleon and Love in 1974 and The Emperor's New Clothes in 2001. Of course, Time Bandits provides the favourite of his three.
Yes.
Stefzen says, has to be Marlon Brando with his deep, moody look in Desiree. Dan Brewer says, Mark describing Abel Gance's 1927 triptych in 3-2-1. We've already done that. Yeah. Roop says, Rod Steiger in Waterloo was a great Napoleon. Martin Comin, sorry, Martin. Ian Holm in Time Bandits, all day for me. 5'1" and Conqueror of Italy. Not bad, huh? And Mike Rudd with the interesting suggestion of Arthur Lowe in Dad's Army.
Refers to him as Napoleon.
All right, Napoleon.
All right, Napoleon.
So that, and that Arthur Lowe's
completely
exactly
forgotten
kind of,
that. I had completely forgotten that that's what he does. He refers, all right, Napoleon.
So if it's not Dad's Army, which Napoleon are we picking?
I am going to go for Napoleon from Time Bandits. I'm sorry, because I just think that that sequence is absolute genius. When the Time Bandits are all falling asleep because Napoleon is just keeps going, Julius Caesar, 4-3.
Steve, emails, please. Correspondence at CobinAmail.com. Steve Hodgson, this has got a great quote in it.
Yeah.
This has really got a great quote.
Go on.
Second email in 1 week from this medium-term listener who once won a Rupert the Bear competition while on a family holiday in Blackpool.
Yes.
I thoroughly enjoyed your discussion prompted by The Mission on religion and how it relates to politics.
Oh, okay, okay.
For some reason, it brought to mind one of my favourite quotes, which from now on will be a lot of people's favourite quote.
Go ahead.
From William McIlvany's Laidlaw crime novel. Sorry, McIlvany. William McIlvany's Laidlaw crime novels,
right,
set in the west of Scotland.
Okay.
Quote, what I've got against folk like Lawson isn't that they're wrong, it's just that they assume they're right. Bigotry is just unearned certainty, isn't it?
Beautiful.
Bigotry,
absolutely beautiful,
is just unearned,
absolutely
certainty.
Beautiful.
Up with the top production team, and of course, down with all forms of unearned certainty. And I think it's just one of those phrases that you think, yes, next time you hear someone expounding that load of nonsense that you all know what it is, it's unearned certainty.
Unless,
thank you, Steve.
Unless what you're bigotedly saying is Ian Holm was the best Napoleon, but that's not unearned, is it? It's just true.
No, that is true. Richie in Hampton, long-term listener, loving the new show, particularly the exquisite job done by the redactor-in-chief. Funny how this got through. Last week, you briefly mentioned private and public schools. And
yes,
how strange it is that we call private schools public, because private and public schools means exactly the same. It goes back to the time when there was no real schooling in the country, except for that provided by the church. Though, of course, you had to be that denomination in order to attend. Not really a problem when all churchgoers in the country were Catholic. But then along came Mr. Henry VIII, do beg your pardon, and changed all that. This eventually led to the situation where there were not local schools for children of different denominations. Enter the idea of a school that was not attached to the church and anyone could attend, anyone from the public. The catch was that without the funding from the church, these schools had to charge fees instead. So public schools
fee-paying.
Whilst parlance has moved on, the name public school has remained for the institutions that date back to these times. I hope this is illuminating.
That's very illuminating. I had no idea at all.
On a second note, I wonder if your good doctors would care to give your opinion on the importance of one of the great Douglas Adams insights.
Okay.
Quote, it is known that the people who want to be in power are ipso facto those least suited to it.
Yeah.
To summarise, anyone who is able to get themselves elected to a position of power should be in no way allowed to do the job. To summarise the summary, people are a problem. Tiggity tonk and down with anyone who forgets the mantra of Spider-Man that with great power comes great responsibility. Yeah. Richie in Hampton, thank you. Correspondence at curbitamayog.com. Weekend watch list and the not list on the definitely watch, all on TV in the UK, stream overseas. Kind Hearts and Coronets on Film 4. Spy on ITV2. Muppets from Space on Film 4. No Time to Die on ITV2. And Radio Days, Talking Pictures TV. Matthew Twigger. Obviously, Kind Hearts and Coronets, yeah. But a massive shout out to The Staith for a masterful comedic movie-stealing turn in Spy. Bye. Lucy McCall.
Get the face off, machine.
Kind Hearts and Coronets, a comedy that gets funnier as it gets darker, full of glorious performances from all the cast, not least the numerous Alec Guinnesses. Simon Morgan, Kind Hearts and Coronets, a gargantuan gift of glorious Guinness. Kat says, has to be No Time to Die. What a way to both end the Craig era of Bond and be the first thing I saw at the pictures in 18 months. I think a lot of people, it was the first time they'd gone back to the cinema. Also, love the brief appearance of my favourite supervillain, Feathers McGraw, at the beginning. From The Wrong Trousers.
From The Wrong Trousers, yeah.
I'd forgotten that. And Sean says, Spy is the absolute best of the Paul Feig 2010 comedies. I go for that. He's one of the only directors who knows what to do with Melissa McCarthy's style of comedy. And Jason Statham is terrific too, which is our top movie of the week.
Well, Spy is magnificent. And I do think that Jason Statham with the face-off machine is hilariously funny. But I'm going to go for Kind Hearts and Coronets because it's one of the greatest movies ever made. And that the emailer who said it gets funnier as it gets darker is absolutely right. This was from the time when you could make properly jet black comedies. Incidentally, I think the plural of Alec Guinness's is Alec Guinness.
Okay, Friday, i.e. today, 4:35. So you've probably
missed afternoon.
In the afternoon.
No, yeah. This drops in the middle of the summer. It's fine. That's a full 18 hours after we've dropped. 16 hours.
Well, yeah. Just watch it.
On Film 4 and it'll be on Catch-up.
Films to avoid on the not list, Barbed Wire on Legend, Mr. Deeds on Great Movies, and Jack and Jill also on Great Movies, Gerard Donaghy. Jack and Jill is irredeemable. The other two, especially Barbed Wire, are good in parts at least. Hun Cut says Jack and Jill is probably the nadir of cinema as a whole, so it has to be that. Martin says likely the one that was the first film to sweep the Razzies, Jack and Jill, and why is Pacino doing this? Mm-hmm. And May Yam says Jack and Jill was so bad people stopped carrying water pails around. And CT says, what, Mr. Deeds is a classic? Anyway, what do we avoid the most?
This is a toughie because Jack and Jill is absolutely terrible. Really, really genuinely terrible, but it has one funny joke in it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you the joke, then you'll have to watch the film, and then we can go for Jack and Jill, which I think everybody agrees is a disaster. So Adam Sandler, as Jill, gets taken back to Al Pacino's house, played by Al Pacino, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Jill is clumsy, and there's an Oscar on the mantelpiece, and Jill causes some catastrophe. And during the course of the catastrophe, she drops and shatters Al Pacino's Oscar. And she says, never mind, I'm sure you've got another one. And he says, you'd think.
Okay, that's pretty good. But it's not
the rest of it is terrible. That's it. That's the joke. Movie. And there we go.
Jack and Jill, great movies, in inverted commas, which is on Saturday at 2:25.
Great movies.
Yes, capital letters as
and,
well.
And an exclamation point, Mark.
Thank you very much indeed for listening. Your questions and schmestions are welcome, and they will be with you on Wednesday, correspondence@kerbinandmayo.com.